Well, it's time for another edition of On Your Money with Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. On the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, we're going to talk about a lot of stuff today, but one of the things we're going to do, Kevin, we're devoting some of the time this month on ways to use your personal finances to make you happier in the new year. Today's topic, one that's a little harder to define, but cheaper to achieve. What's up, Kevin?
Hello there, John. How are you today?
Well, I'm better than nothing.
Good. Well, you sound grateful, and that's one of our topics of trying to make you happier in the new year. We've talked a little bit about getting more time for yourself and how to use travel and experiences to make yourself happier. And now we're going to talk about gratitude. And as I define it, it's appreciating what you have rather than being concerned about what you don't have. And the value of having that gratitude is very high. There are several surveys that talked about people who are happier generally are more grateful. And there could be some chicken and egg in there. But a University of Michigan study found that the effects of ongoing difficulty on depressive symptoms are especially pronounced for older people who were part of the study who were relatively less grateful but did not have a long-term effect on those who were especially grateful.
So what would be some ways that we can become more appreciative?
Let's start with the current economic conditions, both nationwide and globally. Now, they definitely could be better, and they have been better, and they hopefully will be better. But we basically avoided a global financial panic 5 years ago. We're coming up on a five-year anniversary of that big meltdown, and while I certainly would take issue with some of the causes of that, as well as some of the remedies, the fact is we did not launch into a deep global depression, which certainly was a possibility at that time. The economy is getting a little bit better. It's been limping along for the last several years. And as an example of how to look at things in a more positive light, the unemployment level right now, according to the BLS statistics, is 6.7%. Now, that's still high, but that's the lowest that figure has been in the last 5 years. And if you want another way to look at that, 6.7% unemployment means that 93.3% of the people surveyed were employed.
And how about on a personal basis?
Compare your financial situation to others. And many of us, especially people who strive and try to get better at things as they go along, tend to look up and try to have more income, more assets, and we focus on people who are ahead of us, if you will, in terms of income and assets, and rather than focusing on the people who, quite frankly, were in a more advantageous situation. In terms of income, the U.S. median household income is about $52,000 for the most recent figures, and that's about the same as Wisconsin. But that's about $15,000 per person unit. So if you have, if you're in a house with three people, let's say, and you have more than $45,000 of income, you're actually doing better than the U.S. median and probably in Wisconsin as well. Now, globally, the median income is about $10,000, and that's about $2,900 per person in a typical household. And assets are even more of an interesting comparison tool. The U.S. median asset of net worth for adults is about $38,000 right now, but 37% of Americans have less than a $10,000 net worth. That means more than a third of Americans have a net worth that's lower than $10,000. If you're fortunate enough to have a home, about a third of people in America do not own a home right now. About 70% of people do not have a four-year degree. And then in terms of health, about 7 in 10 persons, according to a recent public health survey, reported excellent or very good health, but 40 million Americans are limited in their usual activities due to one or more chronic health conditions, and about 5 million Americans require the help of another person with activities of daily living, and 10 million require the help of another person with instrumental activities of daily living. So there are millions and millions of people who can't even, you know, get up out of their own chair on their own right now. So if you're able to do that right now, maybe it's time to feel a little bit more grateful about what you, where you're at rather than where you're not.
I think my net worth is around $1.85 these days, but I'm just grateful. As my father says, used to say, every day on the green side of the sod is a good day. So, what are some ongoing steps that we might take to help us build a sense of gratitude?
So try to be thankful in what you have and start very small. You know, if you are driving to work right now, be thankful that you have a car that started this morning. Or
Amen.
If you're fortunate enough to have a garage in this weather, that's another thing for which to be grateful. If you have a job to drive to, that's another thing to be grateful for. Even if you have school, you're driving on the way to school. Well, you're going to school where a lot of people would like to be going to school, and they can't. They don't have the resources, or they don't have the time, or they don't even have a school that they can go to. Write down your accomplishments at the end of every day. They don't have to be big ones, but just get some type of journal going where you put in every single day, let me think about what I did well or what happened that was good to me, rather than mulling over all the things that happened that were bad or that you feel like you failed at. Another thing you can do that's been very valuable for a lot of people is to spend time with those who are less fortunate rather than those who are more fortunate, and you tend to have a better perspective on where you are. This was an interesting thing. The Simple Dollar blog was one that I read on an occasional basis. They had a nice little thing in there when they talked about people saying, well, I have to pay bills. You know, oh, this is terrible. I have to pay my mortgage payment, my car payment. They look on those as paying bills as an expression of gratitude for past blessings, saying, hey, I can afford to live in a house and I was able to get a mortgage. That's why this payment has to go back to the lender for it. And finally, say thank you. Write thank you notes. Say thank you to people, whether it's just for a small thing, such as, you know, listening to the show, which we thank you very much for doing, or writing a thank you note to someone who has done something nice for you, or just saying thank you to friends and family members or coworkers and say, I really appreciate all that you do for me.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. You're listening to On Your Money here on the Ideas Network. Here's how you get in touch. If you've got a question for us, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email is onyourmoney, all one word, onyourmoney@wpr.org. All right, we're getting a lot of questions in the On Your Money mailbag regarding the income component of the health care insurance subsidy. Kevin, can you shed some light on this?
Right. Well, this, first of all, only applies to those who have to buy their own health insurance, not people with employer-sponsored plans, unless it's a real bare-bones plans, or people who are covered by Medicare. Those who have to buy it on their own according to the new Affordable Care Act. There is a tax subsidy available, and it's based on your income and your family size and the type of plan you're looking at.
And what kind of amounts are we talking about?
It depends on those variables, and the income generally has to be between 100 and 400% of the poverty level. It also depends on the region in which you live and your family. For example, let's say you have a $45,000 earning two-adult couple with two kids, and they're trying to buy the silver plan. Well, according to the calculator, that silver plan is going to cost about $11,500 a year, but they will receive a credit of about $9,000, meaning that their net cost for that plan will be at about $2,500 per year. Still quite a bit of money, especially on that kind of income, but it's a lot less than what the plan actually costs if they had to buy it outright without the credit.
And how is that income figure calculated?
It's usually modified adjusted gross income, which is the bottom of the first page of the taxpayer's tax form. But then you have to add back in deductions that you might have taken for student loan interest or IRA contributions or savings bond interest that you otherwise would be able to exclude. But it still doesn't include a lot of things that would come under the ordinary taxable income as well. And there's a great calculator on this that you can use. The Kaiser Family Foundation has one up at kff.org. They have a subsidy calculator there, kff.org, and we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
All right, Kevin, let's take a phone call. We'll go first to Joshua in Milwaukee. Joshua, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. I love the program. Say, just wondering, I have a good chunk of money in my 401k, and I was just wondering what your thoughts were on rolling it over into what I've been told is Fidelity, or if you know much about it.
I'm okay with it. Well, are you separating from your employer, Joshua, or this is an ex-employer, I take it?
Nope. It's actually an employer that I'm still with, but I don't know where I'll be in the next couple of years.
Ah, okay. So you're thinking about if you're not at this employer anymore, you have to roll that money over someplace, and you're considering prospective recipients for that money right now, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, I'm fine with Fidelity. Fidelity, Vanguard, Schwab, TD Ameritrade, TIA Cref, USAA. There are a lot of companies out there right now that are in the business of providing a good deal of service for a relatively low cost. And they will not just help you with, you know, the investments and rolling it over and generally doing all the paperwork, but they will also do some a modest amount of financial planning. You know, they might create a financial plan based on your figures for you. Sometimes at that level of $250,000 or more, $500,000 or more in some cases, they might provide a dedicated telephone representative to you so you can hopefully talk to the same person every time when you call in or if you have any questions about your account. But yeah, if you're kind of a do-it-yourselfer and you're okay with that, those are good places to go where they don't just leave you hanging, but they also generally don't charge you huge commissions that you might get if you were to go towards a traditional commission-paid salesperson. The disadvantage of doing that, of course, is unless you find one of the local offices or stores, outlets for one of these places, you're probably not going to be able to have a face-to-face meeting with that person. For some people, that's fine. Other people say, no, I'd rather find someone local who I can sit down with and have a chat with periodically.
Joshua, excellent. Thank
you. Whoops, sorry. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call. You can be the next person to join us for On Your Money this morning, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to On Your Money. That's all one word, onyourmoney@wpr.org. We're going to take a short break, and then Kevin and I will be back with more of On Your Money with Kevin McKinley here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to On Your Money with Kevin McKinley. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kevin, let's go back to the phones, and we'll hear from Kent in Beaver Dam next. Kent, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. And I want to continue on the topic of gratefulness. I'm grateful for WPR, and as such, I'm a sustaining member, and I want to be grateful to all the other sustaining members out there.
Kevin, thank you very much. We are grateful for you and the other members as well, so thank you.
And Kevin and John, have you guys ever thought about going on a comedy tour? I'd love your wry senses of humor.
There are a lot of people who wish I would just go on a tour, but I don't know, comedy or whatever. But you don't get extra points for sucking up to the host, Kent, but thank you anyway.
Well, I digress a little bit. I want to make amends for my friend Gary in Sun Prairie, who sent in a comment via email. He failed to sing your accolade, so I know he's very grateful.
No wonder we haven't answered it.
Yeah. No, actually you did. So, but my question is regarding medical expenses. A year ago, I suffered a major medical catastrophe, and I'm wondering what threshold do I have to hit in expenses, percentage of gross net gross income, before
sure.
I can deduct any medical expenses.
Yeah, the amount is there's a new number. It used to be 7.5% for everybody. It's now 10% for people of adjusted gross income for those under age 65. And there still is a 7.5% ceiling, if you will. Anything over that is deductible for those 65 and older and their spouses. And that 10% figure is of your adjusted gross income. And again, that's on the bottom of your tax form. So if you run a preliminary tax return for yourself, check out that number at the bottom, and then whatever you have that you have to itemize, of course, and then whatever you have that's above 10% of that adjusted gross income figure is deductible.
Kent, okay. Thanks so much for your call. And listen, if the whatever gig you have now isn't working out, maybe you could go on a comedy tour. You know.
I'll think about that.
Okay. We've got an email from Peter in Shawano, who writes, would Kevin please explain what constitutes earned income as it applies to the Affordable Health Care Act? My specific concern deals with the income considered in the government subsidy. I worry that I would be subject to rebating my subsidy if at some point in the year I receive a windfall in a stock sale. Thanks for your frosty insights. Man, everybody's a comedian this morning.
as we mentioned in the previous segment, that would be added into the adjusted gross income, and you're probably going to be affected by that. The bad news about that is that there's really no way around that unless you can reduce your income enough to get below the figure that still would allow them to qualify for the subsidy. The good news is, by definition, paying capital gains taxes is a good thing. You have, or having capital gains is a good thing. You will probably have an increase in your net worth. It will be one time, so it won't be something that will affect them in the future years. And you'll have that extra money on hand from that. The better news is that it's highly likely that if Peter is in the 15% or lower federal income tax bracket, he'll pay no long-term capital gains tax on that sale. So while it may affect his subsidy somewhat, by definition, if he's in lower income and he qualifies for that subsidy, he'll probably not pay any capital gains taxes on that if he can stay below that 15% federal income tax bracket.
Peter, thanks so much for your email. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number to join us here on Your Money with Kevin McKinley, 800-642-1234. Or you could join Peter in sending us an email. The address is onyourmoney@wpr.org. That's onyourmoney, all one word, @wpr.org. Back to the phones we go. Christine in Racine is with us today. Christine, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Couple of questions. If you're married in October, do you need to file married in your taxes, or is it okay not to, just for those 8 weeks?
That's a good question. But your marital status on... Okay, well, let me answer this one first, Christine.
Okay.
Your marital
okay.
status on the last day of the year determines your marital status for the entire year. So even if you were married on New Year's Eve, if you're officially married on that date, then you are married for the entire tax year.
But you can file separately, however, can't you, Kevin?
This is correct.
Can I still file head of the household separately?
That you'd have to... No, you can't file head of household, I believe, in that case for it. But I'll tell you what, there's a neat little tool out there that we've talked about called the Tax Calculator. I think that TurboTax has out there, and we'll put the link back up at onyourmoney.com. But that's a neat way to play around with the different filing statuses and different figures and then help you figure out what the best way is for you to file.
If I file single, will I get it possibly audited? It's illegal. Is that what it is?
We don't as a course of action. We usually don't encourage illegal tax activity here. So
okay,
if you're
so it is illegal.
Christine, it's probably just best to file.
Okay, and then a student loan question. I heard in the past that your student loans after a certain period of time would be null and void. Is that true? Something like after 10 years, if you've been paying on your
For federal student loans, there's something called the income-based repayment plan, and that's at ibrinfo.org. And how that works, Christine, is if you have actual federal student loans, you go in there, and based on your income, they tell you what the minimum is that you have to pay. And you still have to pay interest on the unpaid balance, but if there is it's closer to being decades than just years. But if there is a time that you make those minimum payments that are based on your income, then technically, yes, whatever's remaining after that period of time can be forgiven. And again, go to ibrinfo.org, and we'll put that up at onyourmoney.com, too.
Do you know
I don't know what it is offhand.
Okay. IBR.com.
IBRinfo.org.
Info.org. Okay. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too, Christine. Thanks so much. Earl in Medford, you'll be next. Earl, thanks for joining us.
And thank you, Kevin, for all these years of great advice and a sense of humor. Just top notch.
Thank you, Earl.
And I'm concerned about Microsoft in this particular case pulling out support for people with XP systems, and it just puts you in a big financial kind of do it or get rid of the computer thing. Is there any way, economical way, to deal with this when a company will no longer support its product?
It's a racket. We're going to address this in more detail in the next few weeks, Earl, but I'm glad you brought it up. What's happening is Microsoft has, you know, several versions of their operating software. XP is an older version. Most of us who've used it before aren't crazy about it, but we figure out how to use it and we become comfortable with it. Well, they're not offering support for it anymore, and most people say, well, so what? I drive an old car. I don't care about if you know they're bringing out new models of that. The reason this is important because Microsoft has several plugs and patches for their operating software that help deflect against viruses and other kinds of bugs. And if they're not offering support for a particular program, they probably won't have the updating security patches for that particular operating system. And you'd say, okay, well, great, just go out and buy a new operating system. It's, what, $1,500? It's not that simple because the new operating systems are so bloated that you probably have to buy a new computer to handle the larger operating system as well. So I tell you, Earl, that the good news is that you can get the new operating system, and I've seen prices on laptops that are probably in the $300 to $500 range. You can probably get one of those netbooks that's a little smaller, and you can get what's called a Chromebook, which if you're comfortable using Google's Gmail and storage system on the web, Chromebooks are a couple $100 at the most, and that's a very economical way to get a new PC and not having to deal with the constant upgrade of this. The bad news is then a lot of your documents are, of course, going to be tied up with Google instead of Windows, and you'll have to store them in the cloud rather than on your actual hard drive. And there are other ways around that. But even then, if you look at the use you get out of a PC, when did you actually buy this PC you're using right now, Earl?
It's old. It's about 8 years old.
8 years old. Okay. And let's say you paid, if you paid $800 for it, which would be a pretty high price for a PC right now for most people, and you get 8 years of use out of it, which I'm thinking you will. It's more likely to last longer in the future than the ones from the past have lasted. So if you get 8 years out of it, costs $800, it's $100 a year, and that works out to about, $8 a month or so, which for the amount of use we get out of it, that's a pretty fair price, but it might be time to bite the proverbial bullet and upgrade to a new model. Now, if you don't want to go through this with Windows, you can look at going with an Apple, but you're going to pay quite a bit more for it than you will for a typical Windows-based or an Android-based PC.
Earl, good luck with your computer issues, and keep listening to On Your Money. Let's go to Kevin in Westby next. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Thanks
go
for
ahead.
Taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
My question is this. With any extra dollars I have been using, like in my emergency fund, a money market checking account. And the interest rates have just gotten so low on the one I'm currently using. I was wondering if you had any advice on, other institutions that might be offering higher earning interest,
higher rate
on a checking account.
Absolutely. Great question, Kevin. A lot of people are asking that every time they get their statement. They say, I want this money to be safe, but I'd like it to earn a little bit more interest. And it's not your institution that's screwing you over. Banks, credit unions nationwide, and quite frankly, worldwide in stabilized first world countries aren't paying very much interest right now on secure deposits. You might find maybe 0.5% or something on something that's liquid. You might also find a little higher yield on that if you want to go out a little further, but then you have to lock that money up. And if it's your emergency savings, that's tough to do. You might want to look at splitting some of that money into a CD and maybe putting half of it. And as long as it's one that doesn't have a substantial penalty for early withdrawal that exceeds maybe 6 months or a year's worth of interest, you might be better off with part of the money in that, especially if you don't need it within the time frame. But other than that, go to bankrate.com and you can search in your area for higher paying checking account, money market accounts. You also might want to look at a nationwide provider like Discover or Ally Bank sometimes has a nice feature where they offer that. And some of those financial firms that we alluded to earlier, Kevin, like Schwab and Fidelity And TD Ameritrade, sometimes they offer larger accounts to try to gather assets, and they offer higher interest rate for people who exceed a certain dollar amount in their account. But other than that, it's a problem that probably won't change until interest rates rise substantially.
Kevin, thanks so much for your call today. You're listening to On Your Money with Kevin McKinley. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine today. You can reach the program at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email address is onyourmoney, all one word, onyourmoney@wpr.org. Well, it's time for our Smart Assets segment, Kevin. A year ago, we discussed the risks facing bond and income mutual funds. Now, recent developments suggest that it's a good time to revisit those risks. What's the story here, Kevin?
Well, bond mutual funds can be a good thing. They offer people diversification, meaning you can put as little as $1,000 into a bond mutual fund, and then your $1,000 is spread out over could be hundreds of different bonds of all from all around the country or all around the world. It's supposedly professionally managed, which usually has an advantage to it, although not always. And then you can pull that money back out whenever you want at the closing net asset value of the fund's share price on that particular day. So it's fairly liquid. And usually people have gone into bond funds because they're hopefully getting a higher yield, as Kevin mentioned in his call. He's frustrated because he's not getting any interest or little interest at all on his money market or his checking account. He'd like to find a place with a higher yield. And many people have looked to bond funds over the past 3 or 4 years to try to enhance the yield on their relatively more conservative money.
Okay, well, that all sounds like a really good thing. I'm sensing a but here, however. Where can the problems come from?
You know your buts, John. I'll give you that. There are several potential threats to bond funds. One is rising interest rates. As interest rates rise, the value of a previously issued bond will fall, and so will the value of any mutual fund that has those bonds held within it. Also, we've experienced this in the last 8 or 9 months, is investor preference. People have said, well, they're concerned about the Federal Reserve raising interest rates, therefore they're going to get out of bond funds, and they've jumped into stocks in many cases. That's helped the stock market, but it's hurt the bond market. And the worse the economy gets, the greater chance of a default of these bonds. Now, that happens fairly rarely, but it can happen, and it usually makes the bond difficult to buy and sell, and also means that you probably get back cents on the dollar from the face value of the bond. And then finally, there are expenses of those mutual funds. In a very low return interest rate environment, many bond mutual funds have internal management expenses that can be 0.5% to 1%. It doesn't sound like a lot, but if the bond fund is only returning 3 or 4%, that means 25 to 30% of your yield is being eaten up by management expenses. If it's a good manager and the management team is worth the money, that's fine. But if not, you'd be much better off going with a lower expense bond fund like the ones provided by a provider like Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity.
Okay, so as I mentioned at the top of this segment, we talked about this a year ago. Kevin, what has happened since we last discussed this?
Well, more money has flowed into them as people have been searching for some way to earn some kind of a higher interest rate on their income-producing assets, but not everybody is happy with the results. Last year's flows went into different funds like government funds, short-term inflation funds, et cetera, and those funds actually lost money last year. Long-term government bond funds, according to Morningstar, lost about 7%, and even inflation-adjusted bond funds, which would seem to be more immune to some of the risks that bond funds typically have, those lost about 5 or 6% as well. So people who were trying to get maybe 1 to 2% more in yield in a given year actually ended up losing 5 or 6%. And quite frankly, as Kevin alluded to, we haven't even experienced a big rise in interest rates yet. And so if these funds can go down this much and when interest rates have hardly risen at all, imagine what will happen if the rates actually do rise up over the coming year.
Okay, so given all these pluses and minuses that you've been talking about here, what would you say to current or potential bond fund investors?
I'm still okay with bond funds in certain cases, but you do have to understand the risks. As I mentioned, trying to get just an extra 1% or 2% more yield can cause you to lose 10 to 20% of the net asset value, and you might never get that back unless interest rates go way down again to the level they were when you purchased it. They still can be useful, but I'd like to see people, if they are going to use bond funds, make it part of a diversified portfolio and use very low-cost funds and balance that out with money market accounts and short-term CDs that probably won't pay as much interest yield but won't go down in value if interest rates rise. And keep this in mind, too. We have many people who listen who are public or state employees who are part of the core fund or the variable fund. A lot of that money is invested in bonds, and we've been very fortunate in the last few years that the investments in those in the state pension account have gone up, and people are getting higher checks because of that. But if we have a rising interest rate environment, that may affect those checks in the future and the assets underneath those pension fund accounts.
All right. Let's go back to the phones, and we'll catch a call from John in Milwaukee next. John, hello.
Oh, hi. Good morning. I've been thinking of getting rid of my store credit cards like Target and Kohl's, but I think I heard somewhere that if you dump these cards that you could end up adversely affecting your credit rating. Is that true, or...?
It can, and if you do it properly, it will only affect it in a very small way, and probably not for very long. What one of the components of your credit score is the amount of available credit that you have, and that you aren't using. And typically, the maximum you want to have of your overall available credit, you want to be using about a third of that, and definitely no more, because otherwise, then it starts to become detrimental to your credit score. Two things about this. First of all, John, if you want to cancel the store card, definitely go ahead and do that. It's something that will eventually help your credit score once it's done. But make sure that you write the letter to the credit card provider and make sure that it's clear to them that you are canceling the account and you want it on your credit report that it was canceled at customer's request. There's a template letter that we've talked about in the past, and we'll put a link up to that letter. It comes from, I think, creditcards.com, but it's something that you can keep in a Word document, erase the basic language, and put your own information in. And then once you've canceled the card, check your statement to make sure that, you know, there were no closing fees on it, and if there were, that you're comfortable with them. And then also go back into your credit report at annualcreditreport.com at the three big bureaus and make sure that it shows that it was closed at customer's request, because if it is, sometimes those end up saying that they were closed at the store's request or the credit card provider, and that will hurt your credit score for a longer time.
John, thanks so much for your call today, and good luck with your store credit card situation there. We're going to take a short break and come back. We have some more calls and lots more in store for you today on Your Money. Certified financial planner Kevin McKinley, of course, is with us as he is each week at this time. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
My mama told me you better shop around.
All right, it's not a matter of if the cost of mailing a letter will go up, Kevin, but rather when and by how much. On today's Shop Around segment, what's the deal, Kevin?
Well, we know the answer to those questions, and the answer as to when was yesterday, and by how much is 3 cents for a letter and 1 cent on postcard. The increase was from 46 cents up to 49%. This was the biggest increase we've had recently on a percentage basis. We've had increases every year for the past few years. And then we went several years in the 2000s when it was at 37 cents, and we hardly had any increases at all in the cost at that point.
Well, what were the reasons given for the increase?
Some of the same old reasons that everybody increases prices, but there were some ones that were new and unique. It's, you know, the cost, fuel costs, et cetera, insurance, everything like that. But the Postal Service is a unique organization, which their funding is entirely by revenues since 1971. There's a small portion of that is a government subsidy for the Postal Service providing special services to people. But the problems are that they have declining volume. Annual volume is down 27% in the last year since 2008 that the Postal Service processes. And then also they are required by law now to fund a lot of their retiree health expenses, and that runs into the billions of dollars every single year. And since it's technically a revenue generating and supporting organization, they have to get that revenue from someplace, especially when volume is going down, and we are going to pay for it in the form of higher postage costs.
Okay, so what other changes are we going to see besides higher stamp prices?
We've heard that they were going to drop the Saturday service, and that is probably not going to come to fruition in the near future, but it may at some point. There might be some changes in terms of, you might see more privatization of it. Some of that is already being done. They might start, calculating, if you say, I'm going to send a letter from here to there, we might actually end up paying the actual cost to it if we're sending something up to Alaska rather than, the same cost to send it across town as we do out to Hawaii or someplace. Other solutions, they might start selling advertising on stamps, and people laugh at that, but if you go to the Postal Service website right now, there are a couple extra services, commercial services, of things that you can buy through there, and I'm sure the Postal Service gets some money from that as well. I have the absolute best solution of this whatsoever. I think it'll solve a lot of our problems, and I'm going to take credit for it right now. I think we should have a 1 cent tax on every single email that is sent. And that should not only go for to help the Postal Service out, continue their mission, but I think we can pay off the national debt based on the amount of spam that I receive.
Oh, no kidding. Sign me up. I'm all for it. So what would you suggest we do as individuals to save money on mailing in the future?
If you have to mail an actual document and you don't want to mail it, try getting some fax software, or lo and behold, they still make actual fax machines that you can hook up to your phone line, and several institutions and businesses still have fax services, but you can also scan and email those documents as well. That's a cheaper way to send it. And in terms of payments, use your electronic and ACH payments for bills and things like that. Wire the money if you can, and then you can track it online. That way you don't have to send it in. But one of the best ways to guard against increasing costs is to invest in those forever stamps, and then they'll always be good for first-class mail. And again, if you waited until today to do it, it's going to cost you 49 cents in terms of 46 instead of 46 cents. But had you bought those stamps last year or even Friday, based on the increase, you would have received a 6.5% return on whatever money you put in because of the increase from 46 to 49 cents. So there are a few things that we can guarantee in the investment world other than postage costs will continue to rise at a regular rate. So buying a bunch of those forever stamps right now might be a good return on your investment.
Here's an email from Carl in New Berlin who writes, I'm grateful. Hey, he's grateful. That's good. I'm grateful for a first-class stamp for around 50 cents. I can pay all my bills by check and mail for around $10 a month, including checks and postage, far cheaper than any internet connection. So, Kevin, what do you think about Carl's solution? Forget the internet. Buy stamps.
I agree with him. I think people are going to have a very hard time weaning themselves off the notion that for a couple of quarters you can get a piece of paper that can travel thousands of miles for you and very reliably, amazingly accurate and high level of service from the Postal Service. And I think people are going to have a hard time adjusting to the new world of postal delivery.
All right, Carl in New Berlin, good luck with that. Let's go to the phones. Mark in Waukesha is with us. Hi, Mark. How you doing today?
Hi, good. My daughter's been working now full-time for 5 or 6 years on her own, came with me with a financial question, and I kind of answered some questions, but I didn't know how to answer it. She wanted to pay off her car loan, and I found out that she has, 6 months of money in the bank in case she loses her job, of her salary. Also has maxed out on the 401k as far as what they match from the company she works with. And I didn't know if it would be better to pay it off. There's about $2,000-$3,000 left on it or what to do. So,
Mark, do you know if she is contributing as much as possible to her 401k or just enough to get the match?
I think it's just enough to get the max, maybe a little over, she said, but I don't know if it's
okay.
The max in general. So,
and she's single?
Yes.
I'm not asking for dating purposes. I'm asking for tax filing purposes.
Yeah.
She's single, and she makes a decent income, I take it?
Yeah, she has some other CDs put away and some other cash, too, above what she had to protect her, you know, the 6 month rule.
Okay, and do you have any idea what the interest rate is on the car loan?
No, she got it about two, three years ago, so whatever it was, four.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. If it were 4%, she's probably, being a single person of modest or of moderate income, she's probably going to save herself about anywhere from 10 to 20% on whatever dollars she gets into that 401k. So it's probably a smarter proposition to put that money into her at-work 401k first rather than paying off the car loan, because the car loan's only costing her 4% interest, and she'll save, as I mentioned, probably 10 to, let's say, 20% or 25% on her income taxes. So it's actually smarter to put it towards her 401k. However, I will say this, if she, based on what you said about her already saving in her 401k, having 6 months of savings set aside for it, sometimes it'll just feel good to not be making that payment anymore and have a paid-for car. And then if she wants, she can go get one of those personalized license plates that says, you know, paid for in some weird bastardization of the spelling of the actual phrase.
Mark, thanks so much for your call. Kevin, just as a quick follow-up to that, what about what I've heard some people suggest, that if you pay off a car, that you should keep making the monthly payment to yourself so that when you eventually get rid of the car, that'll be your down payment?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, because it does get you used to putting that money aside every single month. And the other thing that those savings can go for is for eventual repairs. And that way, when rather than getting clobbered and saying, oh gosh, this is a $1,200 bill, you can say, hey, I'm grateful that I have a car and that I saved the money for it, so that I can just write a check for this and not have to worry about it. This is part of the cost of owning an older car. And generally, it's a better idea to keep driving an older car than it is to buy a new one.
Okay, 800-642-1234. Still time for you to get your question in for Kevin McKinley, our certified financial planner on Your Money here on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You can also send an email. The address is onyourmoney, that's all one word, onyourmoney@wpr.org. We have another caller on the line. Jan is with us from Verona today. Jan, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Good morning, Kevin. I have a question.
Jen,
when you were talking about bonds, I have to take my RMD this year, and I'm thinking about taking it all out of the bonds I have invested with Vanguard in my IRA. My account is 31.6% in bonds, split between the total bond market index fund and the intermediate term investment grade fund. And
sure,
because I'm afraid of the bond market, I also have half of that, as many assets in the Wisconsin Deferred Compensation Plan. And
okay,
part of that is invested in the Stable Value Fund. And I'm thinking mm-hmm. about taking my RMD out of the Stable Value Fund. What do you think about that?
Okay, well, first of all, the RMD is the required minimum distribution, for people who don't know, that is required. Janice subtly revealed her age on the air here, but people over age 70 and a half have to take a small amount out of their retirement accounts every single year and pay taxes on it. And the question is, where should it come from? I'd make sure that there are some very subtle differences in the accounts. Sometimes usually you can lump all IRAs together, figure out the RMD amount that you're required to take, and then pull it from one account. But sometimes there are some 403Bs and other accounts that that have to be taken out separately and not included in that. So make sure you're getting the help of a qualified tax person in identifying which one of those accounts should be tapped and if you need to take it from others. And then in terms of the other ones, I'm not crazy about you tapping the stable value account. And the reason being is a stable value account is not perfect. It's not as stable as they'd like you to believe, but it's a neat little thing that most people can't get. And once you pull it out of there, you can't replicate it unless you move other assets already in the account over to the stable value account. So what I'd prefer that you do, Jan, is even when you said, yeah, I'm worried about the bond market, well, the stock market has lost a lot more money than the bond market has. so far in January. And so I'd rather have you pull an equal amount out of all of the different accounts and then even look at rebalancing, because if you have that total stock market index fund, that's probably done very well for you in the past year and 5 years, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I make then the biggest mistake have you... in the world. I fall in love with my stocks. I don't want to touch my stocks.
Well, when things are going very well, that's easy to do. And then we have days like we've had in the last week or so, and then all of a sudden the honeymoon is over. So I would rather have you rebalance it. And like you said, we're a lot closer to the high in the stock market than we are to the low. And so it would probably be a good time to pull it out equally from all the accounts and then maybe even rebalance so that your stocks don't become a too large of a portion of your overall investment account.
All right, Jan, thanks. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for your call. We have another email. This one is from David in Madison. David writes, what are your thoughts on index funds? Also, are index funds in lieu of a Roth IRA a way to manage a Roth IRA?
Well, index funds are technically used. Roth IRAs and IRAs and 403Bs and 401K are really empty jars, and the investments within those jars are what constitutes the money and where it actually goes. And index funds are an investment that people can and maybe in many cases should use. The reason index funds are popular is because they have very low expense ratios typically. And as we discussed earlier, the expense ratios are one thing that you can not only know about your investments, but you can control. You can pick a fund that has very low expenses. And that doesn't mean it's going to necessarily be better or worse than a managed fund or one that has higher expenses. But it does mean that all of the things being equal, you'll earn more net return on one with lower expenses than you will with one in higher expenses. So I'm okay with index funds. I just want to make sure that by index, it usually means it's kind of on autopilot. It's not managed by an individual. The index is just they buy and sell stocks according to a specific pre-established index by someone like Standard & Poor's or the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And because there's usually no management, right, there's no enhanced value, but there's no opportunity for an individual to screw it up above and beyond what the underlying stocks would do. And then because it's kind of on autopilot, there is not a lot of expense to it. So as a component of a portfolio, I am a fan of index funds.
All right, David, thanks for that email. Here's another quick one just as we close the show today, Kevin. Nina in Germantown writes, there are lots of things in life I'm grateful for, especially the beautiful, bright sunshine today. I'm also grateful that my husband and I finally managed to close out a decade-old pre-marriage annuity of his. So for the first time, we have a decent-sized rainy day fund of about $7,000. Where should we put it? I was thinking maybe a no-fee, low-risk mutual fund, but I await your expert advice.
Well, with that type of gratitude, and it's very nice for Nina that the only baggage her husband brought to the marriage was an annuity with the surrender charges on it. So good for her and him. There are very few no-risk or low-risk mutual funds. And if you buy a bond fund, you have to be comfortable with the notion that you could lose 10 to 30% on that in a given year. And if you buy a stock fund, you have to be comfortable with the notion that you could lose 40 to 50% in a given year. If you're comfortable with that, I'm okay with using those low-cost index funds from a place like Vanguard that we referred to. But otherwise, if you want safety and security, you can look at Series I savings bonds. You can buy $10,000 of those per person per year. Go to treasurydirect.gov. They pay 1.18% interest. There's no state taxes on the interest, and that interest rate is adjusted every 6 months according to the Consumer Price Index. So if inflation goes up, so should the rate on those bonds.
Thanks for the email, Nina. All right, Kevin, what is your website of the week?
It's kind of a neat service. It's called Earth Class Mail, earthclassmail.com. And what it does is they actually receive your mail for you. And this is attracted to people who are going to be in a lot of different locations. Maybe they're, you know, snowbirds or they spend a lot of time in other places. And what they do is they actually receive your mail for you, scan it all in so that you can view it online from any single place, and then decide what to keep, what to shred, and then they'll hold it for you as well. Earthclassmail.com. And again, we'll have that up at onyourmoney.com. later on today.
And very quickly, four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more, and thank you, John.
Thank you, Kevin. Bill Martin's produced this hour of programming. Cynthia Schuster handled on-air production. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network.